Michelle Grattan and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. After the 2013 election, Bill Shorten won Labor's leadership contest by securing a majority of caucus votes. But his opponent in that battle, Anthony Albanese, won a bigger share of votes from Labor's rank and file. The question of whether Albanese still harbours strong leadership ambitions is certain to add spice to Labor's next years in opposition. This week, political reporter Karen Middleton is releasing a book on Albanese's life and career. It's called Albanese Telling It Straight, which is a play on his reputation as being a very direct talker. Karen joins us today. Karen Middleton, how did you come to choose this subject for a biography?
Well, Michelle, I've known Anthony for probably 20 years through my political journalism and his back going back to his time in Sussex Street in the New South Wales Labor Party. And I've come to know this personal story of his over the years, sort of by accident, which, as you know, we do in journalism. We find out tidbits about people's personal lives and then, you know...
When we're lucky,
that's right. And when you catch up with them the next time, to be polite, you say, how's that going, or what has anything happened with that? And gradually I came to know this story. And he had told a few people, but not very many, and he kept this story about his father and his personal life very tightly. It's an emotional story for him.
And a very sensational story.
It's a great story. And I'm a journalist. I'm an old-fashioned storyteller, and that's what I loved. And
so tell us something of this story.
So he, I approached him and said, could I tell this? First of all, I was a TV journalist and said, could I tell this story on TV? And he always resisted that. And then I said, what about a book? And I came up with this idea and I pitched that to him and said, would you cooperate? And he decided that he wanted this story told in a proper way, given proper treatment by someone that he said he trusted, in a manner more than just a footnote in a newspaper. So that's how it came about. The personal story is that what has been well known is that he was brought up by a single mother, Marianne Albanese. She was born Marianne Ellery. He lived in Camperdown in inner western Sydney in reasonably poor circumstances in a council flat that she, in fact, lived in her entire life from birth to death. And she had a debilitating illness. She was arthritic and really struggled. There were times when he had to look after himself because she was in hospital. That stuff's all been well known. What wasn't so well known was that she told him when he was young that she had married his father, who he came to understand was Carlo Albanese. Albanese was how they pronounced it initially. And then that she told him he had died in a car accident. They'd only courted for a short time. She'd met him overseas. He was Italian and he died. When Anthony was 14, she sat him down and said, actually, that's not the truth. I'm going to tell you the truth. She thought he was old enough by then. And she told him that she had met him indeed overseas on a cruise, on a cruise ship on her way from Sydney to the UK, to Southampton. He was a crew member. He had been engaged to someone else back home in his Italian town. They'd had a relationship and she'd become pregnant. She'd come back home to Sydney and she was a good Catholic girl. It was the 1960s, it was a conservative period, and she made this story up. And she decided not to adopt her baby out. She kept him. But she said she had married this man. She took on his name. She gave her son his name. She acquired wedding rings, which Anthony still doesn't know where they came from. And she went about this ruse. So she sat him down in the kitchen and told him this story. And she said, do you want to go and try and find your father? Because, of course, he thought he was dead and then suddenly he might not be. But he felt very loyal to his mum and he was kind of an angry young man. And he said, no, you're enough for me. I don't need to go and find him. And he felt that that's what she wanted him to say. So for many years, he didn't go looking. His mother died in 2002. He had married his partner, Carmel Tebbutt, before that, and they'd had their own son. And as his son grew up, he started asking, where's your daddy? And Anthony decided, I think once his mother had passed away, that he would try and find his father. And indeed, through an incredible sequence of coincidences, which are just almost hard to believe, he managed to track him down to Italy, made contact with the family through the assistance of the Australian Embassy in Italy, when Amanda Vanstone was actually ambassador, and through an intermediary, persuaded the family in Italy to meet with him, discovered he had siblings, a brother and a sister, half-brother and sister. But I also think it's incredible that the woman, the wife of his father, who was the woman he went home and married, allowed this, didn't stand in the way of this reunion. I think that was crucial. And he became reconciled with his dad and got to know him. And then that was through the period of the Labour implosion. All while that was going on back here, this personal story was unfolding. His father took ill in 2013, and through the election campaign with the re-rise of Kevin Rudd and then the leadership ballot between Anthony Albanese and Bill Shorten, he knew his dad was dying. And once that ballot was out of the way, I think a week later, he went to Italy and saw him for the last time, and his father died about a month after that.
And with this new family, as it were, has he kept up contact with them?
He has. He's very mindful of their privacy, so we've tried to protect their privacy. They live in a small community in Italy, in the town of Barletta in southern Italy, near Bari, which is the port city where a lot of people jump off to go across to Greece on the ferry. It's down that side of Italy. And he's trying to preserve their privacy. But they're an Italian-speaking family, and he doesn't speak Italian, so he's always had to have a translator with him. His father did speak some English, although that always diminishes as a person gets older. The second language tends to fall away. So he's tried very hard to keep in touch with them, and they have embraced him. It's really quite an incredible story of reconciliation when you think there could have been obstacles on both sides. There could have been suspicion. There was a little initially, it's suspicion. Why has this man turned up? Does he want something from us?
Especially if he's a politician.
Well, indeed. And politicians don't have a great reputation in Italy. I think they didn't quite understand how senior and well-known he was in Australia, but they did rapidly find that out, and that was a bit stunning to them. But on his side, this was a father who never came looking for him either, all through his life. Now, Carlo maintained to Anthony that he didn't know he existed. Anthony doesn't think that was true. He thinks he probably did. His mother told him that she'd contacted him, and knowing his mother as he did, that's likely to have happened, but obviously she didn't get anywhere and he never made contact. So, you can imagine a person in that situation could be quite bitter, but both families put that aside and they now seem to have a pretty lovely relationship, and for his son Nathan's sake, relatives that they never knew they had.
Now, just coming to the life of Albanese that we know much better, his political life, he was very much the angry young man of the left in his early years, very aggressive, in your face as a political operator. Where do you think that anger came from, and to what extent did he mellow over the years, and what was the process of mellowing?
Oh, I think, well, it's interesting. I spoke to a lot of his friends about that anger and some of his enemies, and I think there was anger associated with the family backstory and the absence of knowledge about his dad. He says that wasn't what made him angry, but others observe that it was an absence, that when other people were going off to family Christmas parties with their dads at work or something, he couldn't do that, and there was a bit of a sense of a resentment, they think, that grew up about that. And he had to become a bit of a street fighter, not necessarily in a literal sense, but in a political sense. He had to care for himself. He spent months at home when he was young, minding himself when his mother was in hospital or when she was incapacitated through periods because of this arthritis, and I think he became very independent and kind of, me against the world type thing. And I think that flowed into his politics. He's always been a confident person, and a lot of his friends say that they feel that he's had that confidence and determination from a very young age. And he grew up inside the Labour Party. His mum was a member. His grandparents were members. It was just as natural as breathing to him. They were more associated with people in the right than the left, but he felt his personal politics that I guess really crystallised as he went into university became more to the left. And he did become that angry fighting young man. And university politics, student politics, and particularly the campus of Sydney Uni, where the reputation is very much for hard political fighting, he cut his teeth in all of that, and that became his modus operandi. I think he has mellowed as he got older. He's a more moderate person now. He sees things from different points of view. And the other thing I learned which I sort of knew, but I learned much more clearly from researching this book, is he really plays a long game. He's a very good strategist. He plays a very long political game. And in fact, he's very close to Kevin Rudd, which a lot of his friends and colleagues sort of didn't really understand. And I didn't understand the closeness of their relationship either. And perhaps that's what they have in common. They're both strategists and they both think way ahead. And Anthony's very good at positioning. So he's used that anger in a way to get back at people when he's needed to. He doesn't like to put it like that, but if someone wrongs him, he will get back at them eventually. It might take a long time, but I, you know, there are lots of examples where he has got not revenge, he wouldn't say that, but managed to turn the tables on someone politically, one of his enemies. So if he loses a vote, then way down the track you will find that he wins one kind of 10 times over. That's the way he operates.
He's quite emotional too, isn't he, for a toughy player. I remember that press conference during a leadership battle when he was close to tears.
Yes, and some of his friends and colleagues and supporters get frustrated by that. They think he's too emotional and they don't think that serves him well. He says, well, that's just who he is.
And it's genuine, you think?
I think it is genuine. You know, some people said they thought that was put on. I don't think it was put on. You might criticise his priorities, his motivations, what he chooses to get emotional about, but I don't think it was artificial emotion. I think he does manage to keep a clear head when he's thinking about policy and politics. I don't think I don't think he reacts in anger. I guess that's what I was saying before. He is able to channel that into a longer term approach to his political life. But in the moment, he can sometimes get emotional about things that he cares deeply about, issues and people that he cares deeply about.
It's interesting that during all those difficult leadership years, he was trusted by Gillard, even though she was quite aware that he was actually a Rudd supporter.
Well, this is an interesting thing, and people will make up their own minds about the extent of his role in the re-rise of Kevin Rudd, but there have been relationships that have been broken between him and others that will never be repaired. You're right that Julia Gillard has chosen to maintain a relationship with him, and they are still reasonably good friends that I can see.
But at the time, she trusted him.
She did trust him, and I talked to her, and she's agreed to be interviewed for the book, as did Kevin Rudd. And I talked to her about that, and she felt he was loyal to her, and, you know, sort of almost up until the point that he wasn't, which is, you know, a statement of the obvious in some respects. But she felt that he didn't actively betray her. She felt that he did do his best to keep the government on track, that he did do a good job in that pivotal position as Leader of the House, negotiating with the crossbenchers. She says she thinks he did find a conflict in the end. You know, he was honest with her and said, my support is with Kevin in the end, but she thinks, you know, that he was clear about where his loyalties lay. She doesn't think he went running off to Kevin to tell him things about her. Other people think he did. He says he didn't. Other people think he did.
Just going back for a moment a little further into the past, one of the interesting things, and maybe this goes to the lack of a father figure, but the influence that Tom Uren had on him, who became a sort of substitute father figure, I think was one of the notable features of his life and what you talk about in the book.
And it was interesting. One of the things I uncovered talking to Bruce Childs, who was a senior member of the Left, you know, one of the things you see in the Labor Party is this nurturing of the young people coming through. And the senior members of the Left in New South Wales used to meet together and talk about the young people coming through. And one of them was Albo, Anthony. And they took an active decision that he needed some guidance. He didn't have a dad. They felt that he was a promising young political operative, but he needed someone to give him some guidance, and they actively nominated Tom Uren to do that. Now, Tom offered him a job. He didn't know this part of the story. He didn't know that there'd been a kind of active decision taken to take.
Until you found it out.
That's right. Well, that's what he told me. Tom unfortunately passed away, so I didn't get to speak to him. But the two of them connected in a very deep way. And so it became a very, very genuine relationship. He looked up to him, admired him, respected him. Tom felt very strongly and deeply about Anthony, and they both spoke about each other as if they were kind of like father and son. Anthony presided at the funeral service, memorial service, when Tom died in the town hall in Sydney. And Tom had asked him to do that years before his death. So he became like an extra child to Tom Uren. And I think Tom Uren's left-wing politics, but also sensitivity and personal, the way he carried himself had a huge impact on Albo. I think he talks about the fact that a man, a big man like Tom Uren, and he was physically a large man, he was a boxer, strong man who had survived the horrors of the Japanese prisoner of war camp in Thailand, that he was so sensitive and that he could speak about love like no other man had ever spoken to him about love. And so he had this very multidimensional relationship with Tom, and I think it had a massive impact on him.
It's interesting, isn't it, that the sharpness of the factional system seems much greater in those days when Albo was coming through that system than it seems now. Would you agree with that?
Yes, and they did horrible things to each other. I mean, I've tried to unravel the politics of New South Wales Labor. It is a bit...
Good luck with that.
Yeah, it's a bit unseemly, but for the ordinary person, I've tried to sort of say this is kind of how it works, and you see that through the relationships. You know, when he was coming up through New South Wales Labor, you remember, you know, back in 1980, Peter Baldwin had been bashed, a left senior member of the left, you know, the people associated with the right were sort of through veiled allegations, you know, associated with that. You know, people have denied that, and there's never been any discovery of who did it. But, you know, that typified the kinds of relationships. It was a war within the Labor Party, and Anthony was in the left, and the likes of Graham Richardson and Leo McClay and John Della Bosca, they were all in the right. These days, they're all mates. It's not just the mates. It's, you know, Albo's a mate as well.
And when he was an organiser in the New South Wales Party office, there were all sorts of shenanigans.
Yeah, I talk about that in the book too. They actually physically dismantled his office and moved it to another part of the floor and turned his office into a library, changed the locks just to mock him. He was away overseas on a study trip, just to mock him, you know, and say, we can do this to you, you don't matter. He was the only member of the left in an official position in headquarters in Sussex Street then. It was a position that the left held and the only one. And so they were sort of saying, we're still in charge, you might have an office in here, but you don't matter. When he got back and found this out, Carmel, his partner, had gone in to the office to pick up mail, discovered what had happened, and the left got together, made a plan, and they sent a posse in with tools. You know, there's a lovely story from Meredith Bergman saying, you know, I'm the one from the academics union, and I was the only one who remembered to bring tools with me. And they set apart dismantling what had been done and reassembling Anthony's office just to make the point that you can't mess with us. So, you know, there was a lot of money, time and energy put into hating each other, and physical manifestations like this were not uncommon.
Now, coming to the present, immediately after the election, I think there was a bit of manoeuvring about leadership. Certainly before the election, many people thought that Albanese would run for the leadership. There were plans in place for that. How serious do you think he was in those days immediately after the election? So 48 hours.
I don't think he was especially serious. I think others had designs on encouraging him to run. And I think this is one of the things we should understand, that, it, you know, we often ascribe to the players in these things motives that are actually the motives of others. Earlier in the process, before the election, early this year, when coming back from summer, there was a lot of pressure on Bill Shorten. He wasn't doing especially well. He'd finished the year in a difficult position, and there were people, particularly in New South Wales Labor, saying if he doesn't get better by February, we are going to move against him. So I think they were putting pressure on Anthony then, and I think some of the same people were putting pressure on him after the election. He says to me, and he says in the book, that he, you know, he didn't have designs on doing that. He looked at the result. Bill Shorten had achieved a good result for Labor, and there was no momentum for a change of leader. And so what was the point in trying to cause trouble by running against an incumbent who had been seen to have done well?
Despite not being able to move after the election, to what extent do you think he still harbours leadership ambitions?
Look, he's very coy on this question. He says, I have no plans, you know, I'm happy in the job that I'm doing, I'm happy to support Bill Shorten. But he does concede that he ran once before. And so it would be foolish to say, I think, for me to say, Karen Middleton to say that he has no ambition. He doesn't like to discuss it because he doesn't want to set hares running. And I don't think he has an active plan to run, but he wouldn't necessarily tell me if he did. And I think, having run once before, if the opportunity arose in the future, my guess would be that it would be likely that he would have a go. But, you know, there have been periods in the last few years where I think he could have taken it or left it a bit. I got a sense sort of after the 2013 election when, in fact, you know, he lost the ballot, his father died. He went into a little bit of a wilderness period and was sort of, do I want to stick around in politics? Do I want to do something else? And made a commitment to stay. And currently his commitment also is to stay. But I don't think he's one of these people that dreamed of being Prime Minister when he was young. And I don't think it was even put on him. I think his mum might have said it to him once at one point, as mums of political people often do. But I don't think he is the sort who's been driven to achieve that. And maybe that's why his ambition is a little more latent, perhaps.
Now, I know crystal balls are dangerous things, but do you think he will get the chance to be leader?
I think it's very hard to know. I don't think he wants to be seen as a wrecker. I think the stuff that he got emotional about that time about the Labor Party was genuine, and I think he's quite well aware that if he sort of stepped up and tried to challenge Bill Shorten, that would be seen as a wrecking endeavour. I don't think he's got any desire to do that. That's my assessment. Who's to say if things didn't go well down the track that he would or wouldn't put his hand up? But there may also be other candidates at that point too.
Well, that's right. Is he at risk really of the time coming when the leadership is available for whatever reason and he's seen as a man of the past, that people like Chris Bowen, Tanya Plibersek are more viable candidates?
Sure, I think that's a risk. I'm sure he thinks about it. He doesn't like to talk about that. But timing is everything in politics, as we know. We've seen other people who've missed their time and missed their chance. You know, I think of Peter Costello, who maybe should have taken the opportunity when it arose at a particular juncture under the Howard government and didn't. So I don't know how driven Anthony is to make sure he gets a crack at it. I do still get the sense that it's not that important to him. But then I talk to others who say, oh no, I think it is pretty important. He's just making sure he's keeping his powder dry. So it's a question he really needs to answer. But I think, as you say, there are others like Tanya Plibersek, like Chris Bowen, and maybe even others that may see themselves as candidates. And if too much time passes, they may be seen as experienced enough and the next generation, and he may find that it passes him by. So I think, you know, we'll, the next 12 months to 2 years will give a fair indication of how the Labor Party is going under Bill Shorten, and then we'll see whether there are others manoeuvring to make sure that they're the next cab off the rank.
It'll be an interesting story. Karen Middleton, congratulations on your book. It's a fascinating read, and thank you for talking with us today. That's all from the Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. We'll be back with another interview soon. I'm Michelle Grattan. Goodbye for now.